Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and why the best writers risk being strange. And today I'm going to analyze the movie Parasite. This is a brilliant film that kind of came out of nowhere, it seems. If you were paying attention to the careers of the director and others, you would not have seen it come out of nowhere. So, you know, I was well aware of this crew, this team, as were many people who are hardcore, you know, cinephiles, well before they became the subject of mainstream attention. And Parasite was no surprise to me how good this movie was. But if it was a surprise to you, if you were on the Parasite train and, you know, kind of found this team for the first time, you know, that's a wonderful introduction to a lot of wonderful cinema that you might want to be kind of digging more into and further exploring. But even if you know nothing else and you haven't seen Parasite, this I think will be of extreme use for you. Parasite is a brilliant film in its writing. And it is a film that I think really marshals everything in one direction. Every aspect of that film really serves the ideas in the film. So I'm going to walk through how that is. I will destroy the movie Parasite for you. If you haven't seen it, I will tear it apart, you know, limb from limb, and kind of show you all its pieces in a brief analysis. But nevertheless, it's a pretty thorough analysis. And so if you haven't seen Parasite, you may want to go watch Parasite before you come back and listen to this. So be warned. And also something else you should do right now before you come back and listen to this, you know, just take a little moment, take a little pause, go to strangeinc.ca and sign up to join my newsletter, where it's called Strange Inc. Because my company is Stranger Fiction. And so in that, I'll let you know what's going on with me, what's going on with the company, what we're putting out, you know, in terms of comics, fiction, poetry, whatever. I'll send you some original writing, you know, things that haven't really appeared anywhere else. I'll give you kind of an insight into what I'm writing, give you some drafts, you know, show you what I'm doing, give you tips on writing, and just make some recommendations, you know, recommend great films like Parasite if you haven't already heard of them. So check out strangeinc.ca. It's a great way to stay in touch. It's a great way to kind of just keep up with what I'm up to and what my company is doing and just what's cool in the world today. And also, of course, it just gives you a direct line to me. You can just reply to the newsletter. It goes right to me. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to know what you think about Parasite. So go to strangeinc.ca and let's keep in touch. And then watch Parasite and then come back. And here we go. Without further ado, my analysis of Parasite. Parasite is a film that does an incredible job of a lot of things, but one aspect in particular that I think is notable with Parasite is the way that it has constructed every element of itself to serve the same idea. The idea, of course, you know, summarized in the title, Parasite. It's not a simple idea, and it's deceptively complicated. And yet it does all sort of come across in a very deep and complex manner because of how that film has been put together. Now, if you just look at the title closely for a second, it has a great quality that most great titles have, which is that on first glance, you know, first when you read the title and then start watching the movie, it appears to be about one thing. It appears to have one meaning. But then when you've watched the movie and you have time to think about it, and maybe you're rewatching the movie, the title has a very different meaning. So I think great titles have that quality where they sort of mean one thing to you. Automatically, they tell you something about what this movie is. They set a tone. And they give you a bit of information about what this story is that you're going to be moving into. They do a bit of pre-marketing for the story in that sense. But at the same time, they have a complexity and a depth to them where after you've really read the story or watched the movie or whatever, you know, we're looking at, you know, anything that has a title, you can consider this quality. Afterwards, you only when you are finished, do you really see the true nature of that title and the double meaning that it has? You know, it sort of appears to mean one thing, but that means a second thing. When you look closely or think more about it, Parasite at first appears to be referring to the fact that we have this family, this poor family that infiltrates the household of this rich family. And like parasites, they feed, you know, they literally are feeding on the food. They're, of course, leeching money away from this other family. They begin even to kind of sexually ingratiate themselves into the family. And, you know, we have dreams of getting of the son marrying the daughter and infiltrating the family, you know, much more fully. Notice that in his dream, in his vision for that, it's not about, you know, at one point dropping the deception. It's about, you know, when if we got married, you know, we'll hire actors to play my parents, right? And so on and so forth. And then we also learn as the film goes on that they're the housekeeper that they had replaced. Her husband lives in the basement. There's this other way in which even, you know, this other family has sort of been feeding parasitically perhaps on them. Min, the previous tutor, has again similar sexual designs on the daughter, and so on and so forth. So we have this idea that extends past this family, even that, you know, here is this host family and all these parasites. But look closely at that title. The title isn't parasites. It's not plural. The title is parasite. There's one parasite according to that title. And if you think deeply about the film, very, very deeply, I think what becomes apparent, and this is also something that the director has talked about, the writer-director has talked about in interviews. If you look, if you look closely at that title, it's referring to one parasite. And that parasite, of course, is the head of that rich family, the rich father and company owner. Because if you flip things around a little bit, if you flip the perspective, really, you have that family and arguably, you know, simply the father of the family as the parasite. You know, here is a man who is leeching the labor of this poorer family. They may feel like they're taking advantage of him, but arguably, he's very much taking advantage of them, just as he's taken advantage of others before them. He's leached their labor away. That family can't even do the dishes without paying somebody. Similarly, look at the other instances where we see that man in connection to people who are not necessarily being paid to do something in the home. So there's his wife and his daughter who, you know, there's a number of discussions in the film about his wife and whether or not he loves his wife. And I think that it is hard to say precisely, but by his own admission, he has something more like a thing you could call love for his life. You could call it that if you want, right? But really, you get this sense throughout that film that he's sort of just paying people to deliver to his wife the things that he himself doesn't want to deliver. Like help in the household, as a simple example, parenting his children, as another example, even to some degree, affection for her. You know, arguably, that kind of emotional support is being farmed out to a certain degree. We do see the father doing things directly, like participating in the birthday party, charades, participating in the camping trip, and so on. So it's not that he is completely disconnected from that household, but you do very much get the idea throughout the film that, you know, his wife is there to serve his needs in particular ways. If only, you know, he's, you know, his sexual needs, his, you know, just social need to have a wife, and to have, you know, a daughter who's and a son who are getting into good colleges and so on and so forth. There's this level at which, you know, he seems to have farmed all this stuff off. And you might say, well, but what about the business sphere? Isn't this a man who is successful in business? And really, you know, he's producing this value in the world and others are leeching off of him. Well, let's look at the scene where we see him at the business, where we see him in the office when, you know, we have that sort of little glimpse through the glass wall, and we see this group of people swarming around him with this device, and he's, you know, looking at it and they're asking him questions. Now, we can tell from contextual clues and things that this is, you know, the company that he's the head of, right? And this is the device that they're going to be selling. You know, this is the product then that, you know, one of the products at least, but a product that is standing in synecdoche as a symbol of the other things that this company is going to be producing and developing. And what is he doing in that scene? He's asking questions about it. What does it do? What does it do? Does it do this? Does it connect to my phone? Oh, maybe it should connect to the phone. Notice what is happening here is we have the situation where it's very clear that the company that he owns and runs and which is delivering him wealth, even in that company, we have this scenario where maybe it's, you know, a upper class level of citizenry that he's dealing with, perhaps. You know, he's not dealing with the poorest of the poor anymore. He's dealing with, you know, kind of white collar workers, but he's still leeching off of them. You know, they are the ones who are designing the machine. They're the ones who know what it does and how it works and know whether it can do this and whether it can be made to do that. He's, you know, there, he's paying them because he's, you know, positioned himself in such a way that he can afford to do this, of course. But really, even in that business context, there's nothing about that individual that is delivering value in the world. He's instead, his position is entirely supported, it seems, by these others that he's leeching off. He's paying them, so it doesn't seem like he's leeching off them, right? It seems like they're leeching off him. But of course, what he's paying them pales, as we can see, because of his relative wealth in the society. What he's paying others is nothing compared to the value that they're delivering to him, that then allows him to maintain this massive stratospheric level of wealth. Whatever value they're delivering to him, he's turned a profit on that many times over. And yet is effectively doing nothing. He's simply occupying this position of making, you know, a certain level of decisions and so on. So the film has this thematic idea, okay? Now you could disagree with that thematic idea. You could, you know, make some other argument about, you know, how valuable is this or that or the other thing in capitalist society. But putting, you know, aside for a second, maybe what you may or may not believe about capitalism and its place and value in the world and so on. This is the film's argument. The film's argument effectively is that this man is the parasite. All these others are the victims of the parasite. They may seem, and they may even believe in their heads that they are the ones leeching off him, but really he's leeching off them. This is the film's argument. And notice that the film is going to great lengths to show this division between individuals and to show how that family, that, you know, man and that and his family are parasitically leeching off these others. Even as it appears at first glance to be one, it flips to the other. Notice, for example, the sex scene that we see, you know, in the sex scene where they're hiding on the table, and then we have the child in the yard, and then, you know, the kind of rich family figures having sex on the couch. Notice that the sexual fantasy that excites them is one of pretending to be poor. Their stereotypical version of poor, you know, drug addicted, sex addicts, so on and so forth. you know, dirty, drug addicted sex. This is that they imagine is the kind of sex that these poor people are having with one another in their cars and so on and so forth. Notice that even their sexual fantasies are being leached and parasitically pulling from the poor families that have labored for them. So, you know, even their imagination in many respects is being pulled and leached and parasitically, you know, taken. And we, I think, even get a sense of that where we have the father on the table, you know, accidentally overhearing his, you know, this basically this woman pretending to role play as his daughter that's being, you know, sexually assaulted in the fantasy. And he has to listen to it. And again, there's this, of course, there's, they don't know that the family is there listening. But if they did, I think it's pretty clear that that would just increase their excitement. I mean, they would be horrified, of course, these people were in their home and so on. But it, just in the framework of the sexual fantasy, all of it is drawing on power dynamics and the imbalance of power dynamics as producing a sexy, you know, exciting quality. Notice all the other ways in the film where that operates. When the simplest levels in the film is how it uses the mise-en-scene and how it structures things and scenes around the mise-en-scene. We have, for example, you know, one simple example is the basement apartment. We open the semi-basement, right? You know, this kind of level below the street where these people live. Very clearly, that seems connected to their social class, right? There's a, that's a symbolic representation that these are the underclass, these underclass figures that we're seeing. Even in the house, when they seem to have kind of gone up a few levels and gotten into this better position, even in that house, we see that the house has a secret sort of underbelly where the poor really belong, inside of that framework, and where they're, you know, forced to remain and are banished to or must hide and so on and so forth. So even in that house is, they built that house for the movie that was designed and built specifically to film in. And so it has all sorts of, you know, fascinating symbolic qualities, including, of course, most obviously the basement top, the sort of level division. Also, on the night when it rains and they leave the house, when they've like been hiding in the house and the family comes home and then they leave the house and go back to their home, and then they discover their home is flooded and so on. Notice in that scene, you have a whole sequence where it shows them going from one location to the other. We for the first time get a really lengthy, extended series of scenes where we see them kind of make that journey. And if you look really carefully, that whole journey is downhill. Even when it's level and flat, when they're just walking from one side of the street to the other, and they're just kind of traversing the street in a fairly level way, the director tilts the camera to make it seem. So even the cinematography is kind of playing into this. But even outside of that, they're always going down. They're going down, again, a tilted street. They're going down stairways. They, of course, eventually go down quite a number of stairways, actually. They go into the underground, you know, subway, and then somehow they're still going down, right? If you actually look closely at that scene and the geography of the various scenes that we kind of pass through there in that sequence, it's an impossible geography. There's no way they would just be going downwards constantly the way that they are doing. Obviously, you know, the director has cut out moments when they would have gone upstairs. For example, you know, go down the subway, come back up the stairs to get out of the subway. He's cut the upstairs journey, but he showed the downstairs words journey. And so the film is constructed very carefully in that manner, where we just have this lengthy downwards trek from the rich family home to the semi-basement. Which is already flooded. Of course, it's flooding because water flows downhill and it destroys the things on the bottom and it keeps rising up. And only the only way to be safe from the flood is to be at the top. There's a couple things happening there. One is this, again, brilliance of the film's construction, where it has, you know, been put together in such a way that it artificially in the mise-en-scene is emphasizing the distance socially between these two families. Additionally, we have this metaphor of water flowing downhill, which serves to similarly call to mind that economic trickle-down effect. You know, this is a economic theory that the rich, you know, fund the lives of the poor through a trickle-down effect, and that, you know, if you want to increase if you want to improve the lives of the poor, therefore, rather than giving them money directly, you give money to the rich. You give tax breaks to Jeff Bezos so that, you know, he can pay his workers more and so on. Now, that's the trickle-down effect is sort of how it's discussed in economic theory. Effectively, this has been disproven in the economic theories. The trickle-down effect doesn't really play out as it does in the theory in reality. But that water and the flow downhill, instead of like it flooding and destroying everything, is sort of the visual that we see. This trickle-down effect, far from improving the lives of the poor, is, you know, destroying them. It's washing away their belongings, making them even poorer than they might otherwise be able to be. And the distance, of course, geographically here, is also indicating to us the impossibility or the difficulty of class jumping. All this kind of comes to head by the end of the film, where we have these letters being traded back and forth. So we have, you know, the father writing the letter, sending it out in Morse code, the son, you know, transcribing it, noticing in the Morse code, transcribing it, and the son starts writing a letter back to the father. But even doing that, we have the acknowledgement that, you know, he doesn't know how he would possibly send that letter. How could he transmit it to the father? Again, communication in these scenarios is a bit of a one-way street. The rich can communicate down to the poor. Poor sending a message back to the rich is nigh impossible. And so the only, even, you know, the poor man trapped in the basement of the empty home, even in that scenario, he weirdly has a larger social mobility than he might if he was, you know, still, you know, just that proximity to wealth gives him a certain level of mobility, and he can send a message out, but he still can't even get the message back. You know, there's just no way to kind of communicate back to him. So the son is writing this letter sort of, you know, to his father that he can't send. And in the letter, he lays out his plan. I'm going to become wealthy. I'm going to buy the house. And then all you have to do is walk up the stairs. And we get shown that visually in the film, this very beautiful ending. But the question remains, is this possible? You know, by the end of it, we don't have a clear sense. We get shown it in the film. So visually speaking, and in terms of the way that films work, because we have been shown it visually, we could interpret that in two ways. So either we are seeing on the screen a dream sequence. You know, this is his daydream that he's recording the letter, and the director is illustrating the daydream with visuals. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is, here we have a flash forward. We're seeing him, hearing him narrate as he writes his letter. And then we're flash forwarding to a point in the future where he's actually achieved it. And we're actually watching the real events that are really going to happen in the future of this film. Either way of looking at that is correct. You could argue it's an ambiguous ending where we don't know which of those two ways of looking at it. Is it an impossible daydream? Or is this, you know, showing us the realization of his plan? And yes, he's learned enough through this experience that he actually can figure out how to manipulate and move himself through the world of the rich and become one of them, essentially. It's up to you, the viewer of this film, to decide which of those endings we have. But I will point out there's a lot in that story to suggest the difficulty of doing this. The difficulty of class jumping is so ingrained thematically in the film that it's in some ways kind of hard to understand that letter that he's writing as anything more than a daydream that he could never achieve. But there is also enough that's gone on in the film previously. If it wasn't for this guy in the basement and that other family and so on, one wonders if they could have just kept going. It seems like everything is working fine. Would it have fallen apart at some point because of maybe the sexual interest the son has for the daughter? It's hard to say. There's enough in the film that you can reasonably see this this character as being able potentially in the future to actually class jump and become rich and so on. We've seen, you know, his ability to chameleon-like move through the world. At the same time, the limit that we saw is him rising from absolute poverty to a level of middle class, relative poverty. We didn't really see him get past that. Is it possible? In the world of the film, it's hard to say. We get these different options at the end. It's an ambiguous ending. And it has a sort of level of brilliance there as well. Notice the earlier in the, but that idea that he could maybe cross the line, as you know, the father puts it. The father's always talking about people crossing the line. It's like he likes this new driver because he always seems like he's going to cross the line, but he doesn't cross the line. And the father doesn't like people who cross the line, right? There's an invisible line that you can't cross. The father's on one side and you're on the other side. The labor he's exploiting, the people he's parasite feeding from, they're on the other side, and you know he doesn't want them crossing that line. He doesn't need more parasites to compete with. But of course, you know, we eventually have a line crossing. Once you know, the father of the poor family crosses the line, it's to stab this guy to death, right? So in that sense, we see a line crossing. It's of a different quality, but it effectively is the same kind of line crossing that would have to happen if the son was to move out of a position of being poor into a position of absolute wealth. He would have to similarly cross the line and replace one of these other parasites. There's an interesting ambiguity. There's a great way that the mise-en-scene is being used in this house and in the city in the film to illustrate these various class divides. We have a lot of really kind of brilliant little moments. Cell phones are used in this film in a way that is fundamentally, I think, better than I've ever seen them used in a film. They don't overwhelm or overpower the narrative, but they're very much present in a way that they might actually really be present. And often in movies, what you'll see is people either don't ever use cell phones mysteriously, or their cell phones just suddenly don't work, or they just never take a cell phone out when they would have, or, you know, if somehow the cell phone breaks, they have to throw it away, or, you know, it doesn't get reception here. You know, usually films will just eliminate, if they acknowledge cell phones at all, they'll eliminate them. And often you'll just watch movies that don't acknowledge cell phones. Like nobody has a cell phone for mysterious reasons. Whereas this film, or they're just, you know, they have them, but they never use them. You know, no one's ever looking at their cell phone. And you kind of wonder, you know, is that realism? Parasite has a stunning level of realism in that respect. People use cell phones constantly. They use them in the ways that they might actually use them in real life. And they even are using them in a way that feeds the plot rather than detracting from the plot. And the plot, of course, also has a real tightness to it. It has a really clear set of lines of causality where one thing happens and then another thing happens as a result and then another thing happens as a result and so on. And tracking why things happen in the film is a brilliantly tightly constructed web, where at the same time, the film is keeping its emphasis scene to scene on characters, how characters are doing, how they're feeling, how they're relating to one another, what their attitude is, and so on. The film's not making you pay too much attention to the tight web of the plot. It's really keeping your focus on characters and keeping you connected to them. While at the same time, it accomplishes a lot in terms of the plot. So a number of things to learn from Paris that I think a film well worth watching and rewatching, and a film that has an interesting fundamental ambiguity and a depth that I think only really becomes apparent when you watch it again and again.